Hello and welcome to the Latest Science of Sport podcast. I'm your host Matt Solomon, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Jason Rice. So Jason is a performance and stress management specialist, and he's also the creator of Apnea Survival, a breath control education system. Next to that, he's also got over 30 years of experience in high-pressure situations, and he's coached a number of world-class athletes using breath-holding techniques. So who better today to discuss how you can use breathing to improve your performance? So Jason, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. So can you give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you've been up to until now?
Yeah. Jason Rice is my name. I am the creator of a system of breath control education, or apnea survival, we call it. And main focus is on using breathing and breath holding to manipulate the autonomic nervous system. And that entails everything from enhancing people's ability to hold their breath, particularly under high stress, like in surfing sort of scenarios. And then also just using those, all that system as tools for like things like recovery and also enhancing performance for, you know, general athletes and general populations as well.
Excellent. So before we get into like the details of how people can do that and how it can enhance or improve sport performance, recovery, that kind of stuff, can you give us a quick rundown of some key definitions? So put it this way, the last time I held my breath, I was probably about 10 and it was a competition with mates. So yeah. Breath holding, is it literally just holding your breath?
Breath holding. So, or apnea, some people call it, which an apnea means cessation of breathing. So all a breath hold is a pause in our breathing, either before or after, after the inhale or after the exhale.
So that's like, if we say breath holding and apnea, that's kind of one and the same.
Yeah, same.
It just means you're not inspiring.
You're not breathing. Yeah.
Perfect. So when we have a situation like that, when apnea occurs, what happens in the body?
So generally what happens is we interrupt the gas balance in the body. So when we're breathing, we're predominantly breathing in a mixture of gases, but predominantly we're taking oxygen into the system or into the body, and we're exhaling out carbon dioxide. And when we stop breathing or cease breathing and pause or hold our breath, that system gets interrupted. So the body is accumulating carbon dioxide but depleting its stores of oxygen.
And what does that then mean for what's going on in the body? There's obviously less oxygen. That sounds bad, but what does that mean for example, muscles and the brain and everything that's going to be directly functioning?
Yep. So when we experience periods of hypoxia, what happens at a cellular systemic level in the body, oxygen starts to move more readily from the blood. So when we breathe in, oxygen comes in through the lungs as a gas, and then it gets actually diffused out into the blood, where it's held in the blood and bound to hemoglobin. So, and then as carbon dioxide levels rise in the body, so before we exhale, there's a mechanism called the Bohr effect, which is relative to the amount of carbon dioxide in the body, and it's the presence of carbon dioxide that actually triggers the hemoglobin to have less of an affinity to bind to oxygen, and the oxygen's released, then is diffused out into the tissues and cells where it's used for aerobic respiration. So when we're holding our breath, that flow of oxygen coming into the body is halted and the carbon dioxide level rises. And so what's happening is eventually as the body detects hypoxia, so the lowering of oxygen in the blood, oxygen is prioritized to the vital organs, so the brain and the lungs and the heart, but primarily the brain. So for a period, the brain's going to get super oxygenated and everything else is going to start getting depleted with oxygen. CO2 levels are going to rise up, and the body's going to sort of try and enhance its delivery to the brain to try and preserve the brain function, because that's the thing that's keeping us alive. When we expose ourselves to regular periods of hypoxia, the body starts to actually create adaptions with things like producing more erythropoietin or EPO, which then triggers the production of hemoglobin from bone marrow. So we increase our our amount of hemoglobin and also red blood cells. So the hematocrit, which is the red blood cell sort of percentage relative to total blood volume in the body, gets increased. We also increase our blood capillaries and things, and people have been known to grow secondary spleens. So the body starts adapt to low oxygen by changing itself physically to be able to hold more oxygen and transport more oxygen around the body.
And I am rudely interrupting Jason to make sure that you're aware of the Science of Sport Coach Academy. The Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses, which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. So if you've enjoyed today's podcast and you want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes and you can get into the Coach Academy completely for free for the next 7 days. So hit that link when the podcast is finished.
So these are pretty big aerobic adaptations, right? So when we're obviously looking at sport, then potentially aerobic sports are things that could benefit. But what are then the? I mean, put it this way: when you're riding a bike, you're probably going to still breathe. So it's not necessarily that specific, but you could get some cool adaptations. So what kind of sports are going to benefit from this kind of breath work and this kind of breath training?
Okay, so the main sports are going to be sports that involve breath holding. So free diving is the sort of number one sport where people are holding their breath for long periods of time. So the average trained free diver, their hematocrit levels are about 5% higher than normal untrained populations. So their ability to hold oxygen is enhanced, and their ability to actually utilize oxygen is enhanced. And then sports like spearfishing, surfing, for example, is another sport where the breath holds aren't necessarily long, but they're multiple and they're very intense because there's high levels of carbon dioxide with all the activity. And the carbon dioxide is the thing that actually drives the breathing response. So the more carbon dioxide or higher our carbon dioxide levels are, we have chemoreceptors in the brainstem that trigger the actual breathing response, so that urge to breathe. And when the point of carbon dioxide reaches the level where we'd normally be triggered to breathe, that urge to breathe or an air hunger, it's called, is experienced by the person or the breath holder, and that creates the intensity or stress. So CO2 is like an irritant gas that's designed to stress us and irritate us so we actually continue to breathe. So during breath holds, if they're very long or if they're short and intense, that drive to breathe can be very strong. So one of the main things we do with that cohort of people is training them to have higher CO2 tolerance, so to be able to withstand the psychological stress and also the physiological stress. So there's a threshold set point in the central governing area of the brain that can actually be manipulated. So we do like CO2 threshold training to actually try and move that. And then the body actually becomes psychologically and physiologically more adapted and robust to higher levels of carbon dioxide in the system also.
I think it's really interesting to be able to attack it from those two points, right? So to kind of trick the brain into thinking that this is safe. I mean, that probably the brain is saying, you know what, this isn't safe. We need to breathe. I mean, pretty good function of the brain. But to be able to trick the brain and move that up a level next to all of the physiology that you've just mentioned, I imagine that can have quite a robust effect. But what kind of duration are we talking when someone's underwater and let's say they're doing free diving? Like, what kind of duration of breath hold are we talking here? Because I'm sitting there thinking, might last a minute if I practice a little bit, but these guys are a bit more professional, right?
Yeah. So the average sort of, say for an instructor level freediver, the benchmark standards are depth of 40 meters, which is about a 2.5 minute dive. So that's an active dive going down 40 meters underwater, 100 meters dynamic underwater. So with fins on, swimming 100 meters dynamic underwater, which takes about 2 minutes. And then the static breath hold is 5 minutes is the general. So that's laying static face down in the pool, relax. So 5 minutes is sort of the general benchmark that your base level instructors are trying to head for. The average person has a breath holding capacity of about three and a half minutes with a bit of simple training, a couple of months of training. And that's due to most human bodies will hold about 3.5 minutes of oxygen just in the tissues. So if you can navigate through the stressful part of the breathing or that urge to breathe, which kicks in way before you're actually hypoxic, so there's any chance of blacking out, that helps you then navigate through those longer breath holds. And the world record for the static breath hold, for example, is 10 and a half minutes. That's a conventional breath hold with no manipulation. The unlimited record, so breathing pure oxygen before the breath hold, is like 22 minutes. Whoa. So it sounds impossible, but they're the sort of times that people are looking at. Like Alexei Molchanov, for example, his warm-up breath holds are like 5 minutes, 7 minutes.
Yeah. Is that like doing three reps of that or whatever? Is that half an hour just not breathing? Jeez,
yeah, it's incredible. But the average person with a little bit of training can get up to that 3.5-4 minute mark quite easily, and then that has a lot of transferability outside of just those sports as well.
I think, and I'm excited to get onto the transfer in just a second. But before we do that, just a quick warning as to potential risks of not breathing.
So blacking out. So what a blackout is where we reach a state of hypoxia, where the body actually has a protective mechanism. So hypoxia is like low oxygen levels. The body has a protective mechanism that'll actually black you out. So you basically pass out to prevent you from going any deeper into that, whatever you're doing, that activity that's causing you to have those low oxygen levels. And that comes way after the strong urge to breathe. So when we're training this stuff, particularly in the water, we're working with higher levels of carbon dioxide and focusing on relaxation techniques to navigate through the stress rather than getting rid of lots of carbon dioxide, which then retards that urge to breathe or the or the point at where we get the signals in the body to start breathing. And that happens way before that we actually start getting seriously hypoxic. So it's not till around 70% oxygen saturation where we start to lose our fine motor skills and things start to become a little bit dodgy. But your body doesn't black out till you get down to around that 30%. So that's like extremely low. Most really high level competitive freedivers are operating around that 50% mark quite regularly. And you can actually train your body to be more tolerant to hypoxia, just like you can to be more tolerant to hypercapnia or the high levels of carbon dioxide. So
golden rule, please.
The golden rule is in the water, you're always training with a competent buddy. So someone who's done similar training to you. And also, if you're going to be doing breath holds in the water, you need to have done some sort of formal training to understand the physiology and all the safety stuff that goes with it, and also the actual responses to blackout. So what do I do if my training buddy blacks out or has another thing, what's called loss of motor control? So loss of motor control doesn't necessarily precede a blackout, but it's a result of low oxygen levels in the body where you start to lose motor control. And breathing is actually a movement pattern. So when we start to lose motor control, we actually can lose control of our breathing muscles as well. And that will typically happen when someone comes out of a long breath hold and they start to breathe and they exhale first. So they reduce the partial pressure of oxygen in the body to the point where they start to almost black out on the surface. And they call it a Samba is the slang name for a loss of motor control, because people start to like sort of flap around like they're dancing in the Samba.
love that. The Australians are so kind with the way they work things out. Oh, you know what, man? You look like you're just dancing. Terrible. I had loads of questions lined up, and I'm just making stupid accents.
That's all right. Good. There's 1,000 rabbit holes you can go down with this stuff, so it's easy to detour, down somewhere where we weren't expecting to go.
And you weren't expecting that from me, I'm sure. In terms of sport performance, so obviously you've just mentioned loads of really cool physiology, right? Loads of great aerobic adaptations. So when we're looking to transfer this from sports where it's really clear, it's like life and death, can you hold it longer? Yeah. Will you break a world record, whatever? How can we transfer that to other sports who could be listening thinking, you know what, that sounds like pretty easy aerobic adaptations where I don't have to train 10 to 20 hours a week on a bike or running or whatever. How does that then transfer from this breath holding stuff all the way through to other sports?
Yeah, okay. So there's a few different areas. There's the physiological side of it. So with the constant exposure to hypoxia, so doing breath hold training, the body adapts to operating with less oxygen. So if we put ourselves into that training environment, then when we're operating in an environment that's plentiful in oxygen, then that should enhance our performance. I mean, that's the whole basis of blood doping, is to increase that hematocrit in the body, so we've got greater oxygen carrying capacity. So that's one of the main adaptations of hypoxic training. High altitude training, that people go to altitude to train, which there's a lot of misconceptions about how that actually works. But what has been shown is that people who do regular breath hold training or hypoxic training or free dive training, their hematocrit levels are about 5% higher than people that do, or athletes that don't do that type of training. So in theory, that gives us greater oxygen carrying capacity as an athlete. How much that transfers into your performance is a bit of an unknown, really, because there's so many other nuanced variables with individuals that affect their performance. But it's one of those like few percenters that when we start adding up all those little 1%, 2%, and 3% that we're gaining, that if you're at a high level in a sport, it's a possible game change, particularly if you're doing it in a period before you're going into like a main competition type of thing.
And I imagine the more physiological sports are probably the ones that are going to benefit more, right? So, I don't know, let's say you're going to go play darts, top level darts. You probably don't need this. Elite cycling.
There would be benefits to dart players with this type of training, particularly the underwater stuff, because it's all about maintaining your calm and focus while you're under the stress of experiencing that urge to breathe. So there's at a level where you're operating at a high intensity as an athlete, and sports where you need a lot of repeated sprint ability, for example, like rugby. And one of the actual studies that was done with high intensity hypercapnic training or simulated altitude training was with an Australian rugby team. And from memory, it increased their sprint repeatability by about 30% over a 2-week training period. Now, that's not necessarily a result of the physiological ability to carry more oxygen, because that type of training is extremely intense. And this is another beauty of this sort of training, is you can get an extremely high intensity in the training, but with low physical impact. So the injury risk to the athlete is like pretty low, but the actual mental stress and toughness and resilience that's going to come out of that training is going to sort of lift the bar that athlete can push themselves monumentally. It's seriously tough training. It's ugly.
That's obviously like the mental
wet your pants, you know, literally you wet your pants doing this sort of training because of the dive response. So your body starts to release fluid to relieve itself of the internal pressure.
Whoa, that's a hard sell for a rugby team to be sat wearing nappies on their bikes, trying to get to that level of intensity.
Oh, well, it's a team, you know. It's not like you need a full bucket load, but you urinate. So with breath holding, when you're pushing the breath holds, there's an increase in pressure. One of the ways the body releases the pressure is to reduce the fluid in the body. So you urinate. And in loose terms, that's what's going on. Yeah, and with the intermittent hypoxic hypercapnic training, I tried it a session every day. I thought, how long can I do this for before my body will actually shut down and not let me do it? And 14 days was the most that we could push it out to, and that was doing an assault bike session every day, and it was just a Tabata, so a 4-minute Tabata, holding your breath. It was a reverse Tabata, actually, so 10 seconds of effort, 20 seconds of rest, 8 rounds, and exhale breath hold on the 10 seconds is going flat out. and then just doing one full set of that.
So just for my test. So if I want to go and do this next week, you were doing 10, 20, that was the interval, 8 times, 4 minutes. and you were holding your breath at which point? The point that you started working or the point that you finished working?
No, the point you start working. So it's all nasal breathing as well. So breathing in and out through the nose.
Might have to train to get to that stage, but yeah.
Inhale through the nose, passive exhale. So it's called functional residual capacity breath hold. So it's on a relaxed exhale. So we're down to about, you know, roughly 50% of our lung capacity is released. And then do your 10 seconds flat out while you're holding your breath. And then recovery with breathing in and out through the nose only for that 20 seconds. And then do that 8 rounds. And you'll find if you were an oxypulsimeter, you'll probably get your oxygen down around 50%, 60-50% after the 4 minutes. I tried it with a breathing resistance mask on without doing the breath holds. So breathing, but actually restricting the amount of airflow. And I could get mine down to 80%. That's without breath holds. So you start throwing breath holds into it and you very quickly drop the oxygen levels down into that 50%. And it gets very intense, but it's a really good way to bring a lot of intensity to an athlete and condition them for that stress and intensity without a lot of physical load on their body.
And what are the disadvantages to that before everyone starts doing this and they all completely collapse? So
there's not really any disadvantages. The thing is with really tough, mentally tough athletes, they can black out. So that's there's no, it's not that much of a biggie when you're not in the water. So don't do this training in the water. So caveat on the intermittent hypoxic hypercapnic training or the simulated altitude training, exhale breath hold training, not in the water. This is land-based stuff that we do. The water-based stuff is all full lungs and working with higher levels of carbon dioxide. So the intensity of the breath hold drops in way before we get hypoxic and there's no risk of blacking out. Because you black out in the water, there's actually a central nervous system deficit there, a bit of trauma. That'll actually create a block in your ability to move past that point again in training. So you get a training block. Whereas on the land, it's not so much an issue. It's more if you fall over and hit your head, you know, have an impact injury, that's the issue on the land.
Right, bike helmets on, you'll be safe.
Yeah, bike helmets and yeah, padded suits, you'd be good.
But before we get on to some more specific stuff on because the training stuff really interests me and I can talk for hours on it, but like before we get into more specific breathing protocols, what are other benefits, excuse me, outside of the physiology? So you mentioned psychology as well, and you can learn to push yourself harder, but I can imagine that for some athletes, being able to control breathing more, better, being able to switch off and switch into different nervous system activities, that can be a real benefit too. So can you talk us through the benefits in the psychological side or the central nervous system side to being able to control and regulate your breath better?
Yeah. So one of the main ways, easiest ways to actually control and manipulate an autonomic nervous system, so that's that fight or flight system, the sympathetic system, and the parasympathetic system or the rest recovery system, is through our breathing. So you can do a quick test, put yourself under a bit of stress, either with some physical exercise, and one of the first things that starts to change is your breathing. And if so, our breathing changes and in relation to the amount of stress we put on our body. And that actually works in reverse as well. So when we get put under stress, we can actually rein or control that stress through the way we're breathing. So with the breath hold training, the recovery, the preparation techniques and the recovery techniques that we use to go into subsequent breath holds and move between breath holds, we can also use to control our autonomic nervous system, so our peripheral nervous system, when we're experiencing periods of stress or when we want to get deeply relaxed. And we use a system of, I call them breathing gears. And if you think of the breathing gears as if we're at rest, we're breathing in and out through our nose, we start to do some mild exercise, we're still breathing in and out through the nose, but the breathing's got a little bit harder. There's the exercise gets a little bit more intense. I do this because I'm on the salt bike a lot of the time. And then we start to exhale through the mouth is the next thing. So we're unloading carbon dioxide because as we're ramping up that metabolic activity, the aerobic respiration is starting to ramp up and we're producing more carbon dioxide. So the reason why we breathe harder when we're exercising is mainly to get the excess carbon dioxide out of the body, not so much getting more oxygen in. It's more to unload the excess carbon dioxide. And as we ramp and ramp and ramp up that activity or that stress on the body, we default slowly to mouth in, mouth out breathing, and eventually superventilating, which is so breathing hard and heavy in and out through the mouth. So the greatest amount of gas turnover that we can manipulate, and as fast as we can, because we're trying to compensate for that, the buildup of carbon dioxide in the body. So that's our body breathing in response to the stress. So if I'm stressed, for example, like it could be pre-game anxiety, and I'm nervous and I can feel that that nervous tension in the body, well, I can actually go the other way and work through those gears and slow my breathing down to the point where I'm breathing in and out through my nose, nice and slow, imperceptible breathing, they call it. That's nice, relaxed breathing. And that'll actually settle my autonomic nervous system down and bring me more into that parasympathetic state. So those states don't switch on and off. Just one dominates more over the other at certain times in response to the activity that we're actually doing.
And then let's imagine, for example, you're there, I don't know, World Cup final in your sport, rugby. You've got a penalty in the last seconds to win the World Cup for your country. Yeah. World's watching. Obviously, at that stage, it's stress, right? Like, yeah, you've got huge stress levels. Yeah. What can players do then with the breathing to then start to relieve that stress? Is it a similar scenario to what you've just said? Like, just that going down through the gears?
A thing called a voluntary cyclic sigh. So what happens, and most people don't realize that they're doing it, but throughout a day, you're continually sighing these little micro sighs. And what sighing does is shifts our mental state. So if you think about when you hop into bed at night, and you flop down to bed, so you're unwinding, relaxing. When you get up in the morning, and moving out, and you're ramping yourself up. So what a cyclic sigh is a big inhale in, and you can be through the nose or the mouth. They call it a double inhale, and that's to pressurize the alveoli and push oxygen out into the system. But what it's also doing psychologically is preparing the body with a bit of tension, and then it's a big release, a big exhale through the mouth or through the nose, generally through the mouth, and that lets all that tension go. And if you can do three to five of those in a row, and that'll actually settle your autonomic nervous system right down. And then you switch to nasal breathing when you can, and long, slow exhales are the predominant tool to actually calm that autonomic nervous system down. Because there's a thing called respiratory sinus arrhythmia, and that's the actual connection between your respiratory system and your heart. So one of the main regulators for that is when we exhale, the heart rate drops down. When we inhale, the heart rate goes up. So if I'm trying to get some control back and settle my nerves and de-stress myself, I want to try and emphasize that longer and slower exhale and drop the heart rate down. That brings my prefrontal cortex back online, so the cognitive thinking area of the brain. Because when we get stressed, we move our thinking more to the primitive areas of the brain, and we start running on autopilot. And that's why people do like wild stuff when they're under the pump, because their brain's just running on it, that area of their brain's just running on whatever memory it's got there. So when we start to rein in that autonomic control, so move more into that parasympathetic system, we get more cognitive control back, and we can actually start to think about what we're doing and focus on what we're doing. So for someone who's about to take a goal kick, and this has taken a little bit of time to explain, but you can literally do this in a minute or two and bring yourself out of a really stressed state back into a really focused and relaxed, or not, you don't want to be relaxed when you're about to kick a World Cup winning goal, but you want to be calm and under that pressure. So you can actually have some control over what you're about to do. And then you wind that back, and the way to actually get better at that is to practice it in training. And the more we practice those techniques, what happens is the brain will start to actually recognize the pattern of behavior. And as soon as you start to actually think about the breathing technique, you'll actually switch and start calming down, or, you know, whatever technique you've been using, and for whatever purpose, your body will just start to recognize your thoughts and the preemptive move into that technique, and can't start to drop into that more parasympathetic state straight away. It's quite amazing, actually, when you practice this stuff a lot, how effective it becomes and how simple it actually is to bring back a lot of control. And I've used it. I've got a first response law enforcement background of over 30 years and worked in a lot of sort of real very high-end tactical areas. And I've used all these same techniques with guys that are about to barge into a room, you know, behind a door that's closed, and they don't know what they're about to walk into, and everyone's nerves are up. It's all the same stuff. It's just bringing back control of that autonomic nervous system, and it can be done easily through breathing.
Absolutely excellent. So when we bring all of this together, and I'm conscious that we've gone through loads of different types of breathing as well. But if we're going to say work with an athletic population to be able to then either improve that physiological side or improve the nervous system side, mm-hmm. how are you going to start working with someone who's never done this before? Because like, so some of the stuff you've mentioned, like the assault bike stuff with breath holds, I'm like, if I do that, like, I don't think I can do that for 4 minutes. I might get two out before I just go, I can't. So where do people need to start with this kind of stuff, with some practical examples?
Yeah. So if I was working with an athlete, for example, I would actually assess their normal everyday breathing to start with. So it's no point. It's like, you know, strength and conditioning training. It's no point building, trying to load dysfunctional patterns. So just like movement patterns are relative to like strength and conditioning, or breathing's just another movement pattern. And if people, you know, their biomechanics could be faulty and their biochemistry could be out. So we have some tools to measure those two areas first. And then if the person can, you know, sit in a seat, relax and at rest and breathe appropriately, then we can start to load the breathing. But that would be the first point. So then from a conditioning perspective, it's like, or where are these based on those, sorry, the criteria, the assessment, or where is this cohort of athlete at? And we might not throw them on the assault bike straight up. We might just do like a walking, what we call CO2 table, which is just walking along at a normal relaxed walking pace, exhale through the nose, pinch the nose, hold the nose, walk until you have a strong urge to breathe, stop walking, breathing in and out through the nose for 5 relaxed breaths. Then on the last one, exhale through the nose again, walking. So we just like gradually move into it, because it is super intense training. Most athletes are you can sort of push into the more intense end of it pretty quickly, but we still want to come back. Because the other part of the puzzle is, yeah, it's one thing to be doing all this high intensity training and getting these adaptive responses, but we want to be able to also get the person relaxed and down regulated when they're trying to recover as well, so they can actually benefit from the adaptive responses. And then, excellent. Yeah, so.
No, that's fantastic, mate. This thing's really interesting. So I'm conscious of time as well, because I could make this a 2-hour podcast, but I'm not going to, excuse me. So Jason, massive thanks for your time and effort today. Where can people find a little bit more about you and what you're up to?
So we have our Instagram page is at Apnea Survival. One word, Apnea, APNEA Survival. We don't put a lot of information on our social media. We have a monthly newsletter, and you can subscribe to that through our website, which is just apneasurvival.com.au. And that's where once a month we have it'll be like an area of focus for what we're talking about to do with breath holding or breathing. And then usually a bit of a story that gives some examples of how we've used some of the training techniques or whatever. And then once a month we usually do a post on the Instagram, which will be, you know, the benefits of some sort of training or just a general sort of educational type post, and we promote all our courses on our Instagram as well.
Excellent. Jason, massive thanks. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew. Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks to Jason for all of his hard work on today's podcast. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did at home too. Before you leave, I want to point you in the direction of the Science Sport Coach Academy. And the Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses, which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. So if you've enjoyed today's podcast and you want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes in just a few seconds' time, and you can get into the Coach Academy completely for free for the next 7 days. What's more, every time you complete one of the courses, you get a certificate of completion, which will prove your ongoing education. And if you have enjoyed today's podcast, it'd be fantastic if you could recommend it to a coach, a colleague, an athlete, or a friend. That means that we can keep bringing the best possible guests and best possible content. And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks from me. I'm Matt Solomon of Science and Sport, and I'll speak to you next week.